Case number 15-1036, Southwest Airlines Co. Petitioner versus United States Department of Transportation. Mr. Goldberg for the petitioner, Mr. Schultz for the respondent, and Mr. Harris for the intervener.
May it please the court, good morning. On behalf of the petitioner, Southwest Airlines, with me today are Southwest General Counsel Mark Shaw and Associate General Counsel Robert Knisley. And I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. In its December 17th letter, the DOT handed down express and non-tentative directives to the City of Dallas for the imposition of forced air carrier accommodation at Love Field Airport. There's nothing in the letter that the DOT directives were preliminary, tentative, or non-binding. Rather, the letter is essentially an edict issued by the chief regulatory agency to the operator of Love Field, who relies on that same agency for millions of dollars in funds and airport grants. And the letter states conclusively that the city must honor the forced accommodation of a requesting airline as long, based on a snapshot date, when the request was made, and as long as the pattern of service continues. And this summarily reversed decades of agency practice, which this type of snapshot date and basically permanent forced accommodation had never, ever been approved or ordered before.
Can I ask this question? What if the letter said everything that it says, and then at the end it says the following? Because this letter only offers guidance, it is not intended to constitute a definitive resolution of the dispute between Delta and the city.
That would not be enough, Judge Srinivasan, because...
That would not be enough to do what?
To remove this court's jurisdiction and making this a final order that needs to be considered, because...
You think it would still be final?
It would still be final.
Even if it said it's not definitive?
Yes, it may not be definitive as to the ultimate global issue as to whether or not Delta needs to be accommodated. But the letter is much more narrow in what we're challenging. It has a legal directive without being subject as a preliminary determination or being subject to being revised down the road that says our position is as follows. Forced accommodation must last for the entire pattern of service.
Right, but I take it your argument on this score is that you can have a blanket statement to the effect that the letter is not definitive, but that doesn't mean that there are particular sub-aspects of the letter that aren't definitive. But
that's right.
But as I read a coda that says this letter is not definitive, what it's saying is this letter is not definitive, meaning the stuff that we've talked about in this letter, including the sub aspects.
It would be how the language was used, of course, Judge Srinivasan. If it basically said this is our tentative position, preliminary position, we want to hear what the parties say, we're going to keep an open mind, then of course this would not be a final order. That's not what we have. Or if it said, on the ultimate issue as to whether Delta has been treated right, we are going to have an open mind. However, when it comes to some legal principles, here is chapter and verse what it is.
Okay, so then you've baked into it, and I think that makes sense, the notion that the agency wants to hear further from the affected party. So if it says this is not, it's not intended to constitute the definitive resolution, and then it also says that we'll hear further argument on these or any relevant topic, including the guidance provided in this letter, then you would say it's not final.
If the letter basically said we're keeping an open mind.
Then I guess my question is this, that everything I just said is basically a quote from the Chapter 16 action.
The NOI.
Yeah, the NOI. Well, why can't we just say that based on what we now know, whatever we might have known at the time of the letter, based on what we now know under the letter of the NOI,
certainly,
December 17th letter wasn't final.
If the NOI had gone further and said the statements regarding forced accommodation and use of a snapshot date are withdrawn and revoked, we may get there again, but we jumped the gun, and we want to have an open mind and consider what the parties have to say, then I would agree. I wouldn't be here today.
Why does a party have to repudiate what they said before in order for that language to mean to be taken at face value when they say our decision isn't final. I mean, you know, that's not the way language ordinarily works. It's not, you know, these are my tentative views. You know, if I say I think I'm inclined to agree that this petition should be granted, but those are only tentative views subject to what I hear today at oral argument, that's a tentative view. I don't have to say that I hereby repudiate what my tentative view is.
Certainly, Judge Wilkins, if there was anything in the record where they said one way or another that the directives in the December 17th letter were not conclusive in the consummate decision-making on those issues, I would agree. The fact that they say we're going to have an NOI, Part 16, and we're going to look at the issue as to how the airport is treating Delta generally doesn't mean that they've given any indication to the city or to Southwest or to Delta or the FAA, to the extent they were following DOT's lead, that those three legal directives in the December 17th letter are open to debate. So we have the December 17th letter.
Because the NOI says this, let's just talk about the city for a second and then ignore the distinction between the city and the airlines for now. And it says the city will be afforded a full opportunity to raise arguments in this proceeding on these or any other relevant topic, including the guidance provided by the DOT letters of December 2014 and June 2015. That sounds like a pretty blanket statement to the effect that there were letters that were issued, and now the city is going to have a full opportunity to air whatever's encompassed by those letters.
And it's like the Appalachian Power case that we cite, where the court said, we understand laws are subject to change, and policy, that was actually a guidance document, may change. But for now, it hasn't changed. For the Part 16, they take a long time. They take years. We don't know how long it's going to take. Southwest would not be a formal party. At some point, they might be able to intervene after the hearing date has been set. So we go on for year after year with this, at best, uncertainty. And unfortunately, it's more than uncertainty, because if you're the city of Dallas and millions of dollars depend on your complying with what the FAA and the DOT says you have to do, the only message that's out there right now is in the December 17th letter, repeated yet again in the June 15th letter.
All the uncertainty would be equally the case if the December letter said on its terms, these are our preliminary views, but it's not definitive, and we'll continue to think about it. You'd still have the uncertainty throughout the entire course of the Chapter 16 proceeding.
I don't believe it'd be the same, because if you're from the city's perspective, you would say, okay, it's like there's an investigation out there. If it was just the investigation, or there's a preliminary rule, and we get to comment, and we get to, and nothing is going to happen that's going to be definitive until the process takes place. Here we don't have that. We have the DOT issuing three directives, which are very serious and have interfere with Southwest lease rights at Love Field, and the bell has been rung, and it hasn't been unrung. We would submit, Your Honors, that whatever's in the NOI is not unringing the bell of thou shalt, city, thou, you've asked, and here's what we're telling you, thou shalt make sure your accommodation is in effect permanent, as long as Delta wants those five flights. It has to be based on a snapshot date. And of course, the critical problem for Southwest right now from this is that they were waiting for years to get real use of Love Field, and then they finally get it, and the right amendment is lifted, and then it takes a while to ramp up service. But before they can ramp up that service, Delta makes this request, and now because of the DOT letter, everything's frozen in time, and Delta is using their lease rights, which they paid millions of dollars for. So the NOI doesn't go as far as it needs to. If it said we are withdrawing, we are rescinding, we are suspending even what's in the letters, that would be a different issue. But right now, it's the Wizard of Oz issue. Pay no attention to the man in the room, but those directives are out there. And the city, nobody in the city wants to be the bureaucrat who says, well, we're going to ignore what's in that letter and be responsible for the city losing federal funds. It's a very serious adverse consequence.
It seems to me that we've said time and again, Supreme Court said time and again, that finality turns on a couple of specific consequences, right? And not on whether the agency says this isn't final.
Correct. Exactly.
Right. I mean, that it says it's not final may lead one to some reason to think that it actually isn't final. But if it has the consequences, the two required consequences. It's final regardless of what the agency says.
Absolutely, Your Honor. We cited some of that case law in our reply brief. Agencies often try to do something that'd be helpful, but not always through notice and comment, which was what was required here. We had Judge Srinivasan, I was before you a year and a half ago for the Security Point case, a similar situation where the chief counsel and the TSA had done something in a letter, you know, and this court properly found that that letter was final because it had adverse consequences and it was the consummation of the agency's decision-making process. We have nothing in the record that says that the DOT has agreed to reconsider the three key legal directives in the letter. And we also submit that it's a legislative or substantive rule because it creates new rights for non-signatory airlines.
In Security Point, there was also no subsequent action, right, that along the lines of what's in the NOI.
In Security Point, there was just the letter that Ms. Kerner had written,
yeah,
and it said you can't deal with these airports anymore.
Right. And the agency didn't submit something subsequently that purported to characterize what that letter said.
No, that's true,
yeah.
Nor did they rescind that issue. And as long as it was similar, as long as the airports out there thought TSA wasn't going to be happy if we contract with Security Point, then that was enough. And that's the situation we have now. Because this has created new rights for non-signatory airlines, such as Delta. The DOT directives impose new obligations on the city. Never before, totally unprecedented, that they would have to make these accommodations permanent and in breach and in violation of the signatory airline's lease rights, and imposes a new obligation on Southwest that has to accommodate a carrier, even though, see, what the rules before, the policies before were key on, we didn't want airlines hoarding gates to basically mess with their competitors. In other words, don't pretend to use a gate. That's not in this record at all. Southwest was waiting for the lifting of the Wright Amendment. It finally happened, and they had slowly, for operational and commercial reasons, it wasn't the day after that they started up to 180 flights a day, but they were always prepared to go there. But this interfered in between. And it's happening, and it has a real-world impact. The city, after the DOT letter at issue in this case, issued or signed a consent for the sublease of the United Gates, but said in there, the DOT directive is binding directive that we have to follow. And then the DOT, you know, wants to talk about subsequent events, and they want to talk about the NOI, but the only real significant subsequent event was in June 15th of 2015, the DOT sent another letter to the parties, to Dallas, which reiterated and reaffirmed everything in the December directive. So I think from the city's perspective, the DOT is very clear as to what they want the city to do.
The city also filed the action in district court, right?
Right. 2 days later, the city files its action, says, you know, puts up its hands and says, we're scared, we don't know what to do here. And then the judge, on a preliminary injunction, and we all did supplemental submissions in the last week or so, issues a decision on a state law issue. But what's interesting is he cites for two or three pages the December 17th letter and the June 15th letter from DOT. And then he ends up making a preliminary injunction finding that completely tracks what's in those letters as far as the snapshot date and as far as the permanent duration. So the bell's been rung. There's nothing in the NOI that unrung that bell. We're dealing with a very serious draconian situation right now. And the way to have that relieved is to have this court, with all due respect, vacate the letter. There's no reasoning behind it, just like with Judge Francine Kerner's letter. There's no analysis. There's no attempt to deal with any of the issues. So even the DOT in their brief says, we understand if it's a final order, it's page 36, it can't stand on its own. So we've made lots of other arguments that we think are important as to why it's arbitrary and capricious, why they failed to consider the fact that DFW is in the area and can accommodate all the Delta flights and many other flights, that there's a WARA statute, one of the reasons why we think we have standing. Certainly Southwest was part of the airlines behind the Wright Amendment Reform Act, and that requires various specific things that Delta, DOT, and the city need to abide by, and none of that has happened here. So we think that there's plenty of reasons for why this letter is arbitrary and capricious and violates federal statute. Obviously, jurisdiction is an important issue, but there's nothing in the NOI that unrung the bell, and that's what we need here. We need to have this letter withdrawn.
Mr. Goldberg, am I correct in understanding that you have a separate action filed challenging the June 2015 letter?
That's right, Your Honor.
And that that is pending in this court.
It is, Your Honor.
Now, therefore, here's my question. The June 2015 letter, like the NOI, reflects back on the 2014 letter, but the June 2015 letter specifically relates back, references the durational permanence requirement.
Right. Right?
And actually supplies a rationale for it, which was not in the 2014 letter.
It's a longer letter. They try to do a little bit more.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, they're elaborating.
Sure.
But with respect to your concern, they provide a reason that wasn't in the previous letter. There might be more reasons. There might be counter reasons to unhorse this. They may be on the wrong track, but they've supplied something. So if, as you're requesting, the 2014 letter is vacated, the 2015 letter is still standing. Does the vacature of the 2014 letter have any implications for the 2015 letter?
Great question, Your Honor. We obviously filed suit within 60 days on that letter as well, so that was filed in August. They do a little more, but not nearly enough. By that I mean they don't deal with the WARA issue at all, Right Amendment Reform Act issue. They don't deal with the fact that everything the DOT said in those two letters is contrary to industry and agency practice for 30 years with regard to these accommodations and snapshot dates. They don't deal with, for example, Southwest's argument that you need to consider Love Field as part of the greater Dallas market. So I think we have a very similar argument if it comes to that. I think that we have to take them one step at a time. These cases, that case was stayed. We haven't briefed it yet. We don't think that letter has any more merit to it than the December 17th letter. It suffers from all the same problems. And whatever they did, it was not enough. Now, as far as, again, on
so
the issue...
Would our vacature actually give you any relief?
It would give us that relief, Your Honor, because it would take away the December 17th letter, which the city said was final and binding, which the city used for accommodation principles that embrace that. And we wouldn't dismiss our June 15th appeal, certainly. We would obviously have to continue that unless they withdrew the letter.
Is there anything in the suit filed by the city that would turn upon or be affected by the status of these two letters?
Yes, in the sense that the judge Kincaid, we believe, took seriously what the DOT position was, and he ended up tracking it. Now, he didn't say, it's not his job, it's your job to review the letter under 46110, but he did cite the letters extensively, and if nothing else, there was a psychological issue that's what the DOT was saying.
The situation on the ground, is there a stay order or a hold steady order in the case from the city?
The judge granted the city's preliminary injunction and also Delta's, which meant basically Delta gets to keep those five flights until something else happens. Southwest has filed an appeal with the Fifth Circuit, in which case Judge Kincaid stayed his case. So that district court case is not going on, and there is a Fifth Circuit appeal. As far as the couple of just points to rebut from the government side, we don't think this is an interpretive rule. We don't think this is a policy statement. It's not an interpretive rule because, as in the SimCorp case, there's no linguistic expression. There's nothing in the statute or in a regulation that the DOT was actually construing or trying to define. And it's a general policy statement would have discretion. It would say we want these factors to be considered, obviously. It wouldn't be a binding norm, which is the way these letters are written.
Wouldn't their best argument, though, in that regard be, I think it's the assurances, or maybe it's the competitive plan statute, I think it's the assurances, require the city to operate on a non-discriminatory basis and to make the facility available to the public on reasonable terms. And that seems to be the closest source to which they could come and say, that's what we're doing when we say the permanence of the requirement.
I think that's the source, but this is why it's substantive rulemaking, Judge Ginsburg, because you can't track that language and get to an interpretation that results in their legal directives. In the Sincor case, this court said that the distinction between an interpretive rule and a substantive rule likely turns on how tightly the agency's interpretation is drawn linguistically from the actual language of the statute. Here, whatever the DOT was doing in their letter, they weren't drawing legal directives from linguistically from the actual language of a statute or a regulation. They were making law, which is, you know, they're entitled to do if they follow the APA, which in this case, at a minimum, required prior notice and comment.
So the breadth and generality of those terms and the assurance, as you say, make the link to attenuate, to say this is an interpretation.
In this case, it does.
In fact, it's actually filling it out. It's supplementing. So.
It's legislating, basically.
Can it not be an interpretation of the assurances?
It's maybe not, because the assurances really don't say anything more than what we've been talking about here.
Suppose we could point to cases in which another agency, say the Federal Communications Commission, under the rubric of its public interest mandate, has said things of this specificity and said, you know, that's within the public interest, and was not held to proceed by notice and comment. Would that, that reflect back on whether this is too tenuous in this case?
I know there's a lot of those cases, and every case is different, and the statutes are different. We did cite one of the cases, an FCC case, in our materials, in our opening brief, I believe, for the position that it happened to be an FCC case, but general FCC authority under the statute doesn't give them carte blanche to issue regulations without notice and comment. So I know that's the example that comes to mind, Judge Ginsburg, where, in fact, the general authority of the FCC, which is pretty strong, was not sufficient to avoid notice and comment, and that's in our materials.
And the name of the case again?
I can get it with rebuttal.
That's fine.
I'll find
sure.
it in a second.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Benjamin Schultz on behalf of the government. The agency letter that is challenged in this case is not final agency action, and it's not final agency action for two separate and independent reasons. First, it was not a consummation of the agency's decision-making, and second, the letter has no legal effect.
Are we focusing now on just the portion under challenge, duration, permanence?
I'm sorry.
When you say it has no legal effect, and whatever else you said about it, we're focusing just on one provision that the petitioner is claiming is final.
That's correct. There are opinions offered in the letter, but none of those opinions have legal effect, and that's because before the letter was issued and after the letter was issued, the city's obligations were exactly the same. The city had to obey the grant assurances. It had to obey.
Yeah, but what the grant assurances means was never before interpreted or announced to be that the accommodation be permanent.
Well, but I think that just goes to exactly what the letter is doing. There is a statute, and the statute is somewhat ambiguous. It could be subject to different interpretations. The city approached DOT, and it asked for guidance.
What's the statute, and what's the provision you're interpreting?
Sure. So there are the two grant assurances, and they derive from two statutes, and we've cited them in our briefs. And what the statute says is that when DOT enters into an airport grant, it has to obtain certain assurances. And so the two relevant ones here are, one, that the airport has to be available without unjust discrimination and on reasonable terms. And then also there's a prohibition on granting an exclusive right. And
now,
there's also,
those were not cited as the rationale in the second letter.
They actually were cited as the rationale in the second letter. I think Your Honor may be referring to the first letter.
Well, I'm looking, the first letter had no rationale. The second letter has a rationale, and I think its entirety is this. Allowing a requesting carrier to continue a similar pattern of service is necessary in order to make any accommodation economically meaningful. If a requesting carrier could be pushed out after a short time period, new entrants could have very little incentive to ever seek to initiate services in a limited capacity.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think you need to go one paragraph earlier. And if you look at the paragraph right above that, and I'll just read from it. It's DOT's view that making reasonable efforts to accommodate new entrants or other carriers seeking expansion at Love Field, as described in our December 17 letter, follows the airport's obligation to make the airport available on reasonable conditions and without unjust discrimination. Likewise, efforts to accommodate new entrants or other carriers seeking expansion at Love Field ensure that the airport is not given an exclusive right to the carrier at the airport. So the agency is very explicitly invoking both of those grant assurances and the statute from which it derives. Now, the fact that the paragraph that Your Honor cites doesn't talk about them still doesn't mean they don't derive from them, because what that paragraph is talking about is just saying logically from that previous paragraph that does expressly rely on those grant assurances, in order to make everything that was said in the previous paragraph meaningful, then DOT goes on to explain why it's doing what it's why it's advising what it's doing. But of course, Your Honor, all of this, I think, is irrelevant, because at the end of the day, the city has to abide by the grant assurances, and nothing that the DOT says in this letter in any way changes that fact. At the end of the day, nothing can be done to the city unless one of two things happens. Either DOT files a district court action, or DOT pursues an administrative proceeding, and that administrative proceeding has a final result, and the final result of that is to take some action against the city. So until either of those things happen, the city is in exactly the same position that countless other regulated entities are in when they face an agency guidance letter. As this court has said multiple times, sometimes the writing is on the wall, and an entity may voluntarily conform its conduct precisely because it thinks it knows what the likely outcome is were it to pursue all the way through an enforcement against the agency. But that does not make it final agency action. So just to give an example, in the holistic Candler's case, which is from this circuit, you had the FDA, which issued a warning letter, and it threatened an enforcement action if the manufacturers didn't accede to what the FDA expressed as its view. Now, there's no doubt that the manufacturer felt pressure to conform to the FDA's view. There's no doubt that they felt that pursuing an enforcement action was probably something that wouldn't be very pleasant for them. But what this court explained was that it's still not final agency action, because if the manufacturer wanted to fight about it, it could be there. Well, first of all, it wasn't even entirely clear that an enforcement action would be pursued. And then even if it was, at that point, the manufacturer would have the opportunity to make its arguments, and the agency would make its final decision.
Mr. Schultz, before you get off the subject, you read a portion of the prior paragraph. Can you just tell me where on the page it appears?
Absolutely. It's right in the – so this is page 2 of the second letter, which you can find. It's attached to the petition for review in that other D.C. Circuit case that Southwest filed. Right. I think the paragraph that Your Honor was reading from was the very bottom paragraph that carries over to page 3. The paragraph that I was reading from was the paragraph right above that. So this is on page 2, in the middle.
Well, I was actually reading from the full paragraph on page 3.
I'm sorry, the full paragraph on page 8, then I see the confusion. So if you go back to page 2.
It was two prior paragraphs.
Sure.
I'm going to ask you that now that we're on the same page.
Sure.
if you could just tell me, focus me again on the relevant portion of that.
Yes, paragraph. I'm sorry. So if you go over to page 2 and you look at the paragraph that's second from the bottom, mm-hmm. this paragraph that starts, it is DOT's view.
Correct.
So it is DOT's view that making reasonable efforts to accommodate new entrants or other carriers seeking expansion at Love Field, as described in our December 17 letter, follows the airport's obligation to make the airport available on reasonable conditions and without unjust discrimination. Likewise, efforts to accommodate new entrants or other carriers seeking expansion at Love Field ensure that the airport has not given an exclusive right to a carrier at the airport. So the agency is expressly citing those grant assurances and interpreting them.
Yeah. Well, I see it's citing those grant assurances, but I'm quoting them. But the quotations don't deal with the duration of the accommodation. Or the snapshot.
Well, so respectfully, Your Honor, if you read the agency's analysis, it proceeds first that they talk about the snapshot date, and then they talk about the duration of accommodation. And the snapshot date analysis is based on if you look at the bottom paragraph on 2, they say, as explained in the December 17 letter, our view is that the grant assurances, so again, they're talking about the grant assurances, mm-hmm. And then they talk about how there's a need both for practicality purposes and to avoid gaming the system, i.e., you don't want an incumbent carrier to be able to manipulate the schedules after the fact in order to keep someone out.
So that's by looking to not yet operating, unscheduled, proposed.
Exactly, right. And then, so then if you go to the duration of accommodation, it's a similar principle. The idea here is what you don't want is the incumbent carrier able to see, oh, wait a second, I had this vacancy in my schedule, somebody swooped in and wants to use that vacancy. Now that they've done that, I'm going to retroactively change my schedule and kick them right out again. Because if somebody thought that, okay, I'm going to go through all this rigmarole, I'm going to request an accommodation, and it's going to be a big fight, and it certainly was a big fight in this case, if I'm going to spend all that money to go through that, only to be kicked out in 2 months, 3 months afterwards, I'm not going to bother in the first place. And then as a result of that, what a carrier could do is it could have all that vacancy in its schedule and never actually be tested, never be forced to do the accommodation, because it would always have the threat of swooping in after the fact and kicking someone out.
So this is quite analogous, it seems to me, to the statute, the situation in which an agency says, look, the source on which we're relying is a statute. Here it's the grant assurances, but that doesn't matter.
Right. There's also the competition plan,
yeah,
which
is that one is going to be a tougher one. Right? But the grant assurances, anyway, say, like a statute, say reasonable accommodation and so on. And from that, we are now announcing that it's our view that a reasonable accommodation requires, A, a snapshot, B, disregarding a future, well, that's leads to the snapshot, and be the permanence, the actual permanence of the accommodation.
Well, right? I think it's important.
Because our statute says, or the FCC says, public interest, and how this is what we're saying the public interest requires.
I think it's important to put in context.
Is that a classic topic, situation for notice and comment?
Respectfully, Your Honor, what this court's case law has said is just because the statutory duties may be vague and undefined and the agency's later interpretation gives it specific effect, that does not make it a legislative rule. Because at the end of the day, the real question is, what is the legal effect of what the agency has done? And is there, I mean, first of all, the question is, it can, the way the court has framed it is, can, is there is really what the agency has been doing?
I think legal or practical effect.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, for the finality analysis, it's legal effect, and we don't think that there is any. But even for the legislative versus interpretive rule, right, the way that the court has framed it,
which I've been focusing on, I'm sorry.
Correct. The way the court has framed it is whether what the agency has done could even fairly be described as an exercise in interpretation. So the fact that you're going from broad to specific does not make it a legislative rule. The only question is, not even is the agency right, just could you reasonably say that what the agency has done is tried to exercise its interpretive authority? Because
but that sounds like saying, if we'd gone through comment, would this be upheld as a reasonable interpretation given Chevron?
Not at all, Your Honor. In fact, this court has been very clear that the question is not whether a reviewing court would uphold the agency's actions. Rather, it's just, could fairly describe what the agency has done be an exercise in interpretation? Now, maybe someone would say it's arbitrary and capricious. Maybe someone would say it's outside what the statute reasonably permits. But that's not the inquiry. And indeed, if you go back to this court's decision in the American Mining Congress case and the cases that interpret it, what the court is saying, at the end of the day, we're really—
There's four factors there, correct?
There are those four.
Opinion.
That's correct.
Two of which are completely within the control of the agency, at least two. To say, well, we just mean this as guidance, and we're not going to put it in the CFR.
Sure.
Right? I mean, that's just self-serving. We can't give much, if any, credit to that. I can see if you did put it in the CFR, it would hurt your case, but, you know, you'd have to be crazy to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think Your Honor is right that some of those factors tend not to be relevant in a lot of these cases. But at the end of the day, what the court is really trying to figure out, and this is what the American Mining Congress Court said, and this is what courts interpreting that decision and applying it have said, is really we're trying to figure out, is the agency creating something of legal effect that hadn't been there before?
And the thing
is, but is it doing something? Is it creating something such that what the agency has done is itself binding the party or creating legal effect versus the thing that the agency is interpreting?
So and when is it relevant when the city says, we feel bound?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, actually, what the city told the Northern District of Texas in its complaint was after getting the first letter, it didn't think the agency had issued any binding guidance. It told the district court in Texas that it asked the city for, it asked DOT for further information because it wanted, quote, a mandate and not mere guidance. So the city certainly understood.
Because it doesn't want to run afoul of a standard that could then preclude it from collecting facility fees and getting grants and so on.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, when DOT issues of a notice of investigation, which it has done in this case and commenced further proceedings, it has not cut off the city's funds. The city continues to receive.
No, I understand, but the stakes are very large for the city, so it feels compelled to err on the side of caution, to seek more assurance, to do anything rather than jeopardize that for
I'm sure just like the holistic Candler manufacturers felt like they didn't want to deal with an FDA enforcement action and tons of potential penalties imposed by the FDA, or that any other regulated entity that is threatened by an agency warning letter feels that it may have a choice between...
Right, because I thought there's a lot of overlap between the question of finality and the question of legislative versus interpretive.
Certainly, so, this court's case law has a lot of overlap.
But on the question of finality, if we just, even if it's artificial, if we segregate them for a second, on the question of finality, I thought there are cases that stand for the proposition that practical effects, including the practical response by a party, isn't enough, that it's legal consequence that matters.
That's exactly right. We're looking at legal consequences.
For purposes of finality. Then when we look at interpretive versus legislative, I don't think it's that clean. Is it?
There's no question that this court has described its own case law as a little bit murky in this area. But at the end of the day, what the American Mining Congress court said and what courts applying that decision have said is really what we're trying to discern through all these factors and all this complicated analysis is what the agency has done, is it legal effect? And just to kind of broaden the perspective for a moment, if the agency had wanted to rely on the letters and say to the city of Dallas, hey, you violated the letters, then the agency would be issuing an interpretive rule, a legislative rule. But that's not what's going on here. The city of Dallas approached the agency and said, we want to know what's going on a rather compressed time frame. The agency sent them a letter. They say, okay, well, here's our views. Take it for what you will. And then at that point, after the city continued to not make a decision on the accommodation, when the agency issued its notice of investigation, it didn't say, okay, we're investigating your failure to comply with the letters. It said, we're investigating your failure to comply with the grant assurances. And that was what had legal effect all along, both before and after the letter.
So in the NOI, when the agency says the letter only offered guidance and was not intended to constitute a definitive resolution of the dispute, the way you started off your argument is to say that by nature, this kind of instrument can never have legal consequence because the way the agency operates is to bring an action.
I think that's exactly right.
That seems different from what that footnote is saying.
Well, there's two separate issues here in the finality inquiry. One is whether it was the final consummation of the agency's decision, and one was whether it had legal consequences. We absolutely believe that at the time it was issued, and still today, the letter did not have legal consequences.
And your view on that is that the letter by nature can never have legal consequence.
Exactly.
No matter what you do in a letter, you can be as definitive as you want to, but by nature, that type of letter can never have legal consequence because of the way the agency conducts its business.
That's right. Yes. But in any event, that's correct.
How often do we say never?
Well, I don't think the court needs to go that far in this case, but as a legal doctrinal matter, yes, that letter does not have legal effect.
With respect to that footnote that I was quoting, your view is that that footnote just doesn't treat with a legal consequence. What it's treating with is definitiveness.
Correct.
Which is the other prong.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the court also could read that footnote as stating the obvious, which was that the agency had never intended that letter to have legal effect because it can't have legal effect. The footnote...
That's what I'm wondering is how do you read it? Because that's one way to look at it, but they seem to be doing two... They get you to the same place.
Right.
But there seems to be two ways of looking at that go to different prongs of the finality analysis.
Well, I mean, I think if you read the letter, the NOI as a whole, both that sentence as well as the fact that the agency is talking about how the city will be afforded a full opportunity to raise all its arguments.
About the letters.
They do go to both issues. I think because the letter didn't have legal effect at the time it was issued, maybe less clarification was needed in the NOI as to that issue. And so to the extent that there may have been more ambiguity in the case, perhaps there was more ambiguity as to whether the letter at the time it was issued was definitive. And so...
You're saying definitive is the same thing as final consummation.
Exactly. That first prong of the final agency action test. But you can certainly read that footnote and the later language about the full opportunity as being addressed to both issues.
Anything else?
If there are no further questions.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Harris on behalf of Delta. Just two quick notes on final agency action. So Southwest in its reply brief and at the podium suggested that it might not actually have an opportunity in the Part 16 to raise this issue. So on December 23rd, they filed a 50-page brief and there's a heading that says, the positions in the DOT letters regarding permanent forced accommodation and use of snapshot dates have no legal support and cannot be followed by FAA.
So that's, I think, but that's a brief filed in what?
This was filed before the FAA in the Part 16
in the
part,
not so, in the district court. This is right.
The hearing officer specifically invited both Delta and Southwest to participate, and both accepted that invitation. And Delta is not defending the letters per se, but is certainly saying that's a proper interpretation, and Southwest disagrees. But one way or another, it'll be resolved in that proceeding. And I think...
Is that found? Because I saw that somewhere there was a web address where you can supposedly go and find the files, but I didn't see it on there.
We can put them in as supplemental authority if you'd like. It was a convoluted process, but they are online.
Okay.
And I think the Part 16 is also important because I think it would be really odd for this court... The city is ultimately the regulated party, and it would be very anomalous for this court to pass on what's happening vis-a-vis the city when there's an ongoing regulatory proceeding where the city's actually a party. Because at the end of the day, it's the city's grant funds that are at stake. So I think the fact that the city is not here but is before the Part 16 proceeding is just another reason for this court to stay its hand, both as a matter of judicial economy and as underscoring why there's no finality.
I'm not sure I follow the last part of that. I can understand the kind of practical point about the city being involved, but why does it directly go to how we construe the finality requirement?
Because that's the proceeding that will determine if the city actually violated its grant assurances, and if so, what the remedy would be. So the fact that there will be no consequences for anyone unless and until that process runs its course and the city is found to have violated, I think underscores the lack of finality.
Let me just stay with that then for a moment. So if the city receives this letter and then it doesn't go to court, it simply says, we're reading this letter, it tells us these accommodation arrangements have to be essentially permanent, and therefore Southwest, you're on notice with respect to your leases and so on. Mm-hmm. If you're going to, there's an accommodation that's going to be permanent. That's not a legal consequence?
Well, I think this court's cases are pretty clear that a private party can't turn something into final agency action just by voluntarily complying. And I think the Reliable Auto Sprinklers case is extremely helpful on this because there you had, it was a notice of, essentially a notice of violation, and then there was, the agency said, this is what you need to do to voluntarily comply. And so the party came in and said, the writing is on the wall, they obviously think we violated, they obviously want us to do this, but this court was pretty clear that because there was an administrative process, that was not enough. And I think we actually have a backstop here. So 47.111D is the provision that governs loss of federal funds for an airport, and I think that just absolutely guarantees that the city will not lose a nickel of its funds unless and until the Part 16 process runs its course with an option of review to this court. So this court is not losing its ability to review these issues at the end of the day.
But that sounds like then the argument that the government's making, which is that by nature a letter like this can't have legal consequence because it takes an action like a subsequent action the government could bring to bring about a legal consequence.
Yes, and again,
but then as I understood your brief, you were making a different argument because I thought that your brief says, well, if you look at the letter, it might be final, but then you look at something that happens later and it shows you that it's not final, but then this argument would say that letter could never be final.
So it's a two-part test. I think what we were suggesting in the brief, it did look like the consummation of the decision-making process on part one, but then we said, A, that's no longer true in light of the Part 16, but B, even if it were the consummation of the decision-making process, there's still
have legal consequence.
Exactly.
So on the second prong, you think the letter by nature can never have the requisite legal consequence.
Again, never say never, but in this case, when there is a backstop, it's hard to...
But that the letter, looking at the timing, the December 14 letter, that's the right date, December 2014, leads Southwest to file this case. And then the subsequent documents to which you're pointing, including, I think, the June 2015 letter, follow after Southwest has filed the case. So you're putting entirely in the hands of the agency the ability post hoc to determine whether what it said initially should be treated as final.
Which is exactly what this court has allowed. So in the National Mining Association case, just in 2014, Our case is actually easier than that. So in National Mining Association, the court looked at the subsequent history and just drew an inference from silence and said there's no indication that the agency has sought to apply this in a binding manner. But we can go a big step beyond that, because here, not only has the agency not sought to apply it in a binding manner, but has affirmatively disclaimed any attempt to apply it in a binding manner. So I think this court's precedent is clear that the subsequent history matters.
And that the subsequent history means whatever the agency does after it does the challenged action.
Yes. I see my time is up, unless there are any further questions.
No. This puts us in the grandstand, that's all. We're not on the field.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Goldberg, we'll give you 2 minutes.
Thank you. First of all, Judge Ginsburg, the case which we cited was American Library Association versus FCC 406 F3rd 689. At the very end of that case, the court basically says that the plenary power that the FCC argued, this is page 708, that the commission has discretion to exercise broad authority over equipment used in connection with radio and wire transmissions. It's an extraordinary proposition, this court said. The commission's position amounts to the bare suggestion that if it possesses plenary power to act within a given area simply because Congress has endowed it with some authority to act in that area, we categorically reject that suggestion. So we would say that would also apply here.
Thank you.
I want to bring the court's attention to a case cited in our brief, which is CSI Aviation versus DOT. This was also against the DOT, and it was a case where the DOT had made a determination of very legal significance at the time. A charter was told you have to have a certificate as an air carrier in order to do a GSA contract. And this court found that that was a reviewable decision, even though the agency made the same kinds of arguments that they're making here.
Did you cite that case? What's this page?
Yes, it's 637 F3rd 408. It's the CSI Aviation versus Department of Transportation. The DOT has, in that case, said they've imposed an immediate and significant burden on CSI, which was the contractor who had to qualify as an air carrier. At the very least, this cast a cloud of uncertainty over the viability of their ongoing business, and it put the company to a painful choice between costly compliance and the risk of prosecution, basically, if it gets it wrong. Having thus flexed its regulatory muscle, DOT cannot evade judicial review. And it's a similar situation here. The DOT in that letter did flex their regulatory muscle, and they can't try to say, well, it was just guidance or it didn't really count.
But the directive was to the petitioner in the case, correct?
Yes.
Here the directive is, if it's a directive at all, is to the suit.
Right, which actually makes it even more difficult for somebody like Southwest, because we're not.
It's, exactly.
It does, but
legally as well.
It makes it more difficult for us just to sit around and not do anything or challenge this type of legal directive, because we can't control what the city ultimately will do. We can't, even though we are making submissions in the Part 16 case when we're allowed to. Of course, we're going to if somebody asks us to. It doesn't mean it's going to have any ramifications in the next several years.
And you're already intervener in the district court case, are you not?
We were a party. We were sued along with the others at the time, actually. Again, in Appalachian Power, this court said it's irrelevant that the guidance is subject to change. Again, as one could say, the NOI might or might not have, because the entire guidance reads like a U case. It commands, it requires, it orders, it dictates. And that's the same situation here. It may change down the road, but right now it continues to command. The National Association McCarthy case is cited by, I think, both parties, and there is very different than this case, because there the final guidance at issue was meaningless, as the EPA had noted. There was no legal impact. It didn't tell any regulated party what they must do or not do. Here we have the DOT letter, which does, in fact, tell the airport exactly what it should do or not do. I think that counsel for Delta said that this was all about the city, and the city should be the one at issue. But no, it's about Southwest very much, too. They paid millions of dollars for these additional gates that they have to basically give for a nominal amount for infinitum time to Delta. So their lease rights are directly impacted, and the city is not the only person with an interest here. Finally, I just want to make clear on the record, it may or may not be in the materials you have. I know it was, I believe, in the materials of the district court action, but there was a letter from Delta Council on February 23rd, 2015, that said, while Southwest is free to challenge DOT's and the city's decision, as it has done so by filing its petition, unless and until the city or DOT's position is legally overturned, we respectfully submit that the DOT letter is binding and sets forth a clear path for resolution of this longstanding dispute. So Delta has been all over the map on this, and even in their own brief, as Your Honor noted, they say, well, if you just look at that letter, it does look like a final order, and in fact,
sounds like both Delta and Southwest have filed things on one hand that say it's final, and on another thing says it's not final in various proceedings.
And you know, if it's not final, it's not final. And we don't have a problem with our 60-day issue, and nobody's going to come and say, "Well, the DOT issued a letter on this; you can't challenge it." But until that day happens, we have to assume the worst. And the worst is we've got a letter that's live out there. And you know, if it's a non-event, it's a non-event. At this point, we have to be concerned.
Everything you've said on rebuttal has gone to finality. It may bear later on legislative versus interpretive, but you've been presenting this all to show legal finality.
Well, actually, the first thing, Your Honor, was the FCC case we had talked about before, okay. And that, okay. I think, was in connection with interpretation.
Right, that aside.
Yep.
So when you say the letters to the city, but the effect is on Southwest lease rights, there's no legal burden on Southwest lease rights, right? It's that the value of them is diminished by the uncertainty about what they'll amount to when all proceedings are over.
Well, as we sit here today, the bundle of rights that Southwest has is reduced somewhat because of this letter. That the Southwest ability to exercise its lease rights in Love Field for 18 gates is now impacted by the existence of this letter. If they wanted to do a transaction with somebody, it would clearly have an impact. Right now,
well,
there's five flights.
There'd be a lesser value.
There's a lesser value.
Every other term of the transaction with a third party concerning these gates would be unaffected, except the price.
I don't know that there could be a transaction if they wanted one because of this stain on the lease rights. And as a practical matter, of course, Southwest is not able to use five flights a day, which they desperately want to use and intended to use, and that's money that the Southwest is not getting. So it has a real-world impact, and we believe if this letter is vacated, yes, maybe we have to deal with the June 15 letter. Maybe depends on what you guys do, but we take it one step at a time. Getting this letter vacated would be very important to Southwest being able to fully exercise its lease rights in Love Field.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.